Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, how are you today?
Good. I've got the gatto at my right and coffee at my left, so I'm locked and loaded.
Dude, coffee, past noon. Man, you're crazy. I had to switch to tea. Otherwise, I just can't sleep, I think.
I had a friend. It's pretty off color. I'll pass on it right now. I have a commentary on tea, and I'll share it with you later.
I appreciate that. Thank you for not sharing that with the world.
Yeah.
All right, so we got another good group of questions this week. I think we're going to start with one on dairy and soy and inflammation, which I think is a good question. We'll start from there and then kind of spin through the list. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
All right, so we got a question from Jesse, a longtime CrossFitter follower of your blog. He just saw this study posted online by the Conditioning Research blog and wanted to bring it to your attention to get your take on it. It focuses on dairy intake actually lowering inflammation in obese test subjects. He doesn't understand the body chemistry enough to make sure of why this would happen. So this is from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and I know you got a chance to take a look at it, so why don't you give us your thoughts on that, Rob?
Okay, so we have this original piece that was done, like you said, American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. We'll post a link to that piece. Title of it is Effects of Dairy Compared to Soy on Oxidative Inflammatory Stress in Overweight and Obese Subjects. So the folks get in, they basically are providing some dairy-type protein sources, dairy sources versus soy sources, and then they're measuring some various markers of systemic inflammation. They have some ways of assessing oxidative stress, malondialdehyde production, some inflammatory markers, including tumor necrosis factor, interleukin-6, and some other goodies. And then this other item called adiponectin, which adiponectin is a hormone that is usually released by fat cells, and it is very, very synergistic with leptin. And both of these things, both leptin and adiponectin, have some really potent effects on our levels of body fatness and our perception of hunger and whatnot. Typically, if we have high adiponectin levels, then we have low body fat levels. So it's an inverse kind of relationship with this thing. So in this study, they fed these folks soy, and they fed these folks the dairy, and then the folks who ended up getting the dairy ended up getting some dramatically decreased levels of systemic inflammation, particularly the adiponectin metabolites. And so they were basically saying, okay, dairy is a good source for an anti-inflammatory kind of effect out of the diet. Which, if you were to talk to me, I would normally say that dairy would be a pro-inflammatory sort of food, but for a couple of reasons. One of them being lectin load that is being carried through the gut. So animals consume grains. The lectins of those grains get concentrated in the dairy. We consume that dairy, and so we've got the potential for some gut irritation from that. And then also dairy is a pretty potent insulin stimulator. And so that high insulin level would then theoretically produce some high systemic inflammation. And so this study would seem to kind of point that it, would be wrong, a wrong assumption, but it definitely paints the fact that soy sucks. So like that's probably as good a thing as we can get out of that. So that's kind of the background with that study. A couple of days ago, I received another study from Pedro Bastos, and that one is from the well-read journal Liver International, the title of this is A Serum Adipokine Levels Predictive of Liver Injury from Non-Alcoholic Fatty Liver Disease. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is essentially fatty liver that is associated typically with insulin resistance. And so in a lot of my talks, I mentioned to people that when we consume carbohydrates, the carbohydrates can fill either liver or muscle glycogen. If it fills liver glycogen, then once that liver glycogen is full, then any additional carbohydrate that goes into the liver typically starts producing triglycerides. Those triglycerides then can lead into elevated triglyceride levels systemically, which will bring down insulin sensitivity. and also can lead to what they describe here, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And this fatty liver, it's basically as the liver literally becomes marbled and inundated with fat, you can imagine that the normal processing of the liver, which the liver is our detoxification organ, it breaks down all of the hormones, environmental toxins, all that sort of stuff, and helps break them down, make them more water-soluble typically, and then we remove those toxins either through the feces or the urine. So during a non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, you end up getting worse and worse and worse liver function. What they found in this study, however, was that high adipokine levels, the same thing that we're talking about in the other paper, tends to be counter to the fatty liver problem. If you have high adipokine levels, then we tend to have low relative fatty liver disease. And so what they're finding is that high insulin levels lead into this problem of inflammation. And so what we seem to be seeing here, on the one hand, is that dairy reduces these problematic it's reducing some problematic things like tumor necrosis factor, interleukin-6, and whatnot, and then it's elevating some beneficial things like the adipopectin. My pronunciation of that is horrible. So all this stuff is kind of like, okay, whatever, what the heck is going on? But when you dig in a little deeper in this adipokine metabolism, what we find, and I'll pull up this paper so I can tell everybody the title, will also have this in with the show notes. Do I have the right one? Let's see here. I have another one here. Oh, here we go. I have it in a different browser window. This other one is from adipinopectin, magnesium, and arterial stiffness. This went into the trace elements and electrolytes, third quarter, volume 3. It's basically a book that talked about trace elements and minerals and whatnot that relates to medical pathology. What this thing is talking about is that the adipinopectin is mainly driven, its levels are driven more by mineral status than by anything else. And the folks in the original paper mentioned this, that the high calcium-containing dairy products are likely the reason why the high adipinopectin levels are occurring. But what this other paper indicates is that by simply taking a magnesium supplement daily, you get exceptionally high levels of adipinopectin. And so if we go all the way back to like Protein Power Life Plan and the chapter that they had, the magnesium miracle, we've known for a long, long, long time that magnesium is a really important cofactor for a number of different metabolic processes, energy production, ATP production, all that sort of jive. Every once in a while, we will have something pop up on the radar that seems to indicate that calcium is really important for energy production and fat loss and all that sort of stuff. And this is kind of the main claim to fame that dairy products have for kind of fat loss related stuff. Whenever a study pops up that shows that dairy has some sort of anti-obesity, anti-fat sort of effect, the main effect that they seem to hang all this stuff on is on calcium. But my point here is that we can get the same effect from magnesium. What we need to find, and I didn't have time to do a whole lot of digging on this stuff, but what do we see with regards to adipinopectin levels in somebody who's eating a grain-free, dairy-free, paleo-type diet that is high in magnesium, is getting adequate levels of calcium, but then we're not getting any of the other systemic inflammation markers that we're seeing from a standard like grain-based diet? So I don't know if all that stuff makes sense, but the basic deal there is almost any of these foods, whether we're talking dairy, even wheat and rye and oats and barley, all of these things have constituents in them which we would normally call anti-inflammatory, or they would work as an antioxidant. So none of these foods are like 100% bad, but then when we look at the food as an overall experience for what it does in your body, then our net effect may not be that great. Something that these folks were not considering when they looked at the effect of dairy on these inflammatory markers, if we have a net acid-yielding diet over time, that in itself becomes a systemic inflammatory problem. So, I mean, it's a really complex topic, and probably everybody has turned off the podcast and is asleep at this point, but that's my best analysis of this whole thing.
So you really simplified that, Rob. It only took 10 minutes to get through.
I know it was complex for me, and so I can imagine everybody was kind of like, eesh, what's going on? The take-home out of that is that the main anti-inflammatory effect with regards to the adiponopectin, in my opinion, from that dairy is from the calcium content of dairy. We all know that dairy ends up having a net renal acid load that is net acid loading. So in the long run, that's really not getting us anywhere. And then we know that some simple administration of dietary magnesium, either via vegetable matter or like something like the Natural Calm or just like a ZMA supplement or something, that also affects favorably the adiponopectin content or circulating levels of that, which the higher the adiponopectin and lectin levels, then the lower our body fat levels are.
Yeah, and I think the other takeaway for me is that little brief snippet of time where you talked about sort of the overall experience of the food. Because I think, to your point, some of these studies are looking at very myopic outcomes and not considering things sort of in the grand scheme or the net acid load and all those interesting factors.
Yeah, and, this is that thing again, which is perfect for somebody to give it a shot, throw in 2 or 3 glasses of milk a day and see how you look, feel, and perform for a month. And then pull that 2 or 3 glasses of milk a day or yogurt or cottage cheese or whatever out and see how you look, feel, and perform. And if you feel like you do better, then God love you. Go for it. It still should be largely hung on this experiential situation. But what we see again and again and again is that when people remove, by and large, dairy out of the diet, then they tend to lean out and they tend to have lower levels of inflammation as reported by like recovery from exercise and some other issues.
Sure. All right. Good stuff.
Hopefully. Or it was a great cure for insomnia, one or the other. So.
Well, hopefully we'll weave in some simpler questions as well, Rob. We don't want to lose any of the 5 listeners,
Totally. Yeah. That would be horrible.
One listener and we dropped by 20%. No, I'm just kidding. All right, so next we got a question from Miss Spinach, and it's kind of a two-parter. So first she says, interesting validation on the 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight rule of thumb. She's a recovering semi-vegetarian and gluten-intolerant individual who finds it difficult sometimes to shovel in that much protein without the help of some digestive enzyme supplements. Question 1, she's confused about which macronutrient makes it easier for the body to utilize the amino acids it is getting from the protein one is eating. By eating more protein or by eating enough fat? In short, why might I feel better supplementing with certain amino acids even if I'm eating plenty of protein? Should I skip the aminos in pill form and eat more protein or skip the aminos in pill form and eat more fat? My concerns are general, maintain performance, leanness, sleep, and mood.
Holy cow.
That's a good question, Rob.
There's a mountain of stuff going on there. So folks know that I do generally recommend protein intake levels that would be above, say, like a standard zone level. So we've seen a ton of people that were following like a weight-measured zone, went kind of unweighed, unmeasured paleo, saw some significant performance uptick, and probably one of the biggest factors that they had is that they started increasing the level of protein that they were taking in, and typically they were upwards of a gram to like a gram and a half of protein per pound of body weight per day. The deal with that, I talked to James Fitzgerald about this stuff, and he's like, yeah, people might benefit from more protein, but ultimately this goes back again to absorption. And Sarah, who is Miss Spinach, alluded to this. She finds it difficult to deal with that much protein without the help of digestive enzymes. Totally agree with that. And this is where maybe you don't even need a gram of protein per pound of body weight. What you need is some digestive support so that you can actually absorb the amount of protein that you need just out of, say, like 0.75 grams per pound of body weight, you know, much more along the line of zone recommendations. I'm not really too sure where all that stuff breaks out. I do know that a ton of people benefit significantly from the addition of a digestive enzyme. I really, really like the Now Foods Super Enzymes. This thing has betaine hydrochloride in it, which is hydrochloric acid, folks. If you use it wrong, it can hurt you. So if you use this, bad on you, like you're warned right now, you need to use this right. People have a tendency of like kind of half-hearing what I mentioned in the podcast and then jumping in and doing stuff. If you're going to use this Now Food Super Enzyme, you got to use it right. You need to take it with a meal that contains protein and fat. Protein is something that was alive that had a face and a soul. Beans and rice don't count. Nuts and seeds don't count. Then, you know, and you start with one capsule per meal, and you see how you feel from that. Then you go to two capsules per meal. You increase the number of capsules per meal until you feel a slight warmth in the epigastric region, you know, right where you imagine your stomach to be. Once you hit that level, if it's like four capsules per meal or five capsules per meal, whatever, then you dial it back by a capsule. And you keep running at that level until you can titrate down to three capsules, then two capsules, then one capsule. What's happening typically is that people are hypochloritic, they're low stomach acid, they're not producing enough stomach acid, they're not producing enough kind of digestive fire to digest their protein, or their vegetables, or their fats, like the whole mix is kind of stymied. A zinc tally test is another way that you can help this stuff. I'm not going to touch on the zinc tally test right now. I think what we're going to do is actually shoot a short stretch of video on that, because a picture of this stuff I think would help. We can draw some photos and draw some pictures and kind of actually illustrate what the whole zinc tally test is involved. But that's a piece of all that stuff. So that's the whole digestion, enzyme supplements, and all that. So you may or may not need a gram of protein per pound of body weight. You very much likely do need some sort of a digestive support. I think most people would probably benefit from that. And again, you know, you just give it a shot. You'll feel and perform better. Do you feel like your digestion is better? Like, are your poops looking like better poops and all that sort of stuff? If you haven't checked out your poops, then I guess good on you. You probably don't have any digestive problems. Then on this other piece where Sarah's asking about, like, should she or should she not take specific amino acids in addition to just generally eating more protein, amino acids, she doesn't mention which one, so it's really hard to tell with this. You know, like arginine taken by itself before bed or pre-workout seems to be a really potent stimulator of nitric oxide release and of growth hormone release. And so maybe that's good. People who are generally overweight, they frequently are carnitine deficient. Carnitine is an essential amino acid in the process of transporting fat into the mitochondria of our cells to be used as a fuel source. Some people, especially if they're this is where like the high-carb, low-fat, low-protein diet can just bugger people. They have inadequate carnitine levels to be able to metabolize their fat. This is where somebody who's heavy, even though they may weigh 300 pounds, we're trying to get them to eat 300 grams of protein a day. One thing that's very satiating, and they tend not to have any room to eat anything else after they try to get their 300 grams of protein in, but then also they're getting adequate levels of carnitine and some of the other amino acids that are important in fat metabolism. So without knowing exactly what Sarah was taking and for what, it's kind of hard to comment on, you know, whether or not she should or should not take these other amino acids. Branched chain amino acids are great pre and post-workout. I don't know if that's the stuff she's talking about. In general, kind of a ketogenic diet tends to be protein sparing, so a higher fat, lower kind of carbohydrate, moderate protein diet tends to be protein sparing. So instead of using protein as a fuel source, we tend to use it as a building material. So that is helpful. Andy, does that seem to answer that question? Does that make sense?
I think that makes sense. I think it's a further reminder that we need to do in early January, the supplement show, which I'm sure will generate in and of itself 100 offshoot questions, but I think it will help on some of this stuff, kind of whittle, you know, the list down to, you know, what we think are the meaningful ones, et cetera.
Right. Well, we'll see.
Well, 4 hours later, you'll still be talking, but I don't know if anyone will be listening at that point.
Probably not. My wife definitely does not. So.
All right, cool. Let's move to the second part of Sarah's question. Question about glycation. If the body can convert dietary protein into sugar if too much protein is eaten, how much is too much when you're dealing with someone who is really overweight and for whom the 1 gram of per pound rule means a huge amount of protein? I'm worried about giving this advice to someone who is visibly insulin resistant, but getting that guy to eat more protein is probably easier than getting him to eat more fat. Everyone is still so fat phobic. So what are your thoughts on, you know, that 1 gram per pound of body weight rule as folks start to get heavier and heavier?
This was straight from Poliquin. Like, Poliquin was pretty insistent that you push people in this direction. And I alluded on some of the whys previously. One of them is that it's a really potent appetite suppressant, protein is. It really is satiating. People tend not to get hungry. There's a thermic effect of protein, so we tend to burn comparatively higher calories processing protein versus carbohydrate or fat. That's a real moderate consideration, but I mean, it still kind of factors in there. And then there's also the carnitine deficiency, which most people that are this large may in fact be carnitine deficient, and so trying to get them to eat that much protein is very, very helpful in that regard. Then there's the other issue that people have a tendency of bitching that they're hungry, and so this is the deal where it's like, oh, you're hungry? Well, 300 grams of protein ends up being like 300 ounces of protein, or not 300 ounces, 1 ounce is 7 grams, so it's... you know, it's like 150 ounces or whatever that breaks down to. That's a lot of protein. So when you lay out a meal plan for somebody like that, you're like, well, you need to eat, you know, basically like a 8 to 10 ounce hunk of protein plus some vegetables, plus have a little drizzle of fat with it. You need to do that 4 or 5 times a day. Then get back to me about how you're hungry after that. Now, if the person bitches about like, well, I'm bored with this or whatever, then that's their own problem, and you need to figure out whether or not they're going to comply or how you're going to motivate them or what's going on, but they're not going to be hungry on that. They may in fact be bored. They may be getting off of crack, but you know, it's not as yummy as Little Debbie snack cakes, but that's not what they're, you know, theoretically coming to you for if you're a coach or trainer or whatever. So there's some good backstory on all that stuff about that level of protein. Everybody from Mauro Di Pasquale, Poliquin, I think even Czech gets up in that higher protein level. But all these folks, too, are definitely looking again at how the digestive fire is going. Like, are people actually making enough hydrochloric acid to be able to digest any of the protein that they're eating?
Yeah, I think the other thing that folks that I always like to be reminded of is that even if you're eating lean cuts of meat, there is some fat in the animal. I mean, obviously it's predominantly protein, but it's not like they're eating straight protein.
Right, absolutely.
And so, you know, I think that's an important consideration. But I think, you know, we see that, you know, this works. I don't know if a lot of folks, even if they're 300 pounds, can eat that much grams of protein in a day. But, you know, I guess more power to them if they can actually consume that. But I think most of the folks find if they can get closer to that 1 gram, obviously depending on the digestive stuff, they tend to feel better, they're fuller, they recover from workouts better. I think most things get better.
Yeah. And, you know, Michael Rutherford, Josh Everett, just a ton of people that I really respect. All of these people, when I've asked them, you know, what's one thing that you notice really makes a difference in your recovery? And they're like, gram of protein per pound of body weight. Just done. Now, none of these people I haven't worked with Josh on his food. Interestingly, in January, I'm going to start working with him to make another run at the game. So we're going to start working together. We're going to definitely be looking at his digestive situation and all that stuff. I haven't worked with him. I don't know if Rut has really looked at his digestion or anything. But that's another piece of the puzzle to look at. You know, like, are these people producing enough digestive enzymes? Would they benefit from digestive support? And if so, then do you still need that gram of protein per pound of body weight? I'm not sure. That's a newer area for me, for sure.
Yeah, and that would be something really interesting to kind of see how all that plays out. Because, I mean, that would make a big difference in some folks' diet. I know for myself, I do better when I get up closer to that 1 gram a pound, you know, body weight. But that I feel like I'm always eating.
Right.
It just takes a lot of effort. You know, I know there's some folks that are always hungry. I don't fall in that camp. And it is hard to eat, you know, 240 grams of protein a day.
That's a lot of fuel to drive that truck.
That's right. Should be the theme of the podcast. All right, good. Next, we got a question for Chris. It's a three-parter. We're actually going to skip part three, glutamine, because we're going to put that in the supplement podcast. But the first one is, you mentioned in one of the podcasts that liquid food causes an insulin spike and should be avoided until after fat loss, weight loss. But what about soup? Chris has found it really useful to put all his non-starchy veggies and sometimes meat into a soup. Whenever he feels like eating fruit, I just have a mug of this and it stops all the craving for sugar. Also seems to keep him fuller longer. So is this okay if all the ingredients are paleo, no starchy carbs, or will it still mess with an insulin spike?
anytime we, the more we process any food, the greater the relative like glycemic load or insulin load is going to be. So now if we take, this is the problem where it was really funny. One nutrition gig that I did, this guy was just all fired up about juicing and he kept saying, you know, he was like, what about apple juice? If I juice, you know, fresh organic apples. And I'm like, well, then you have fresh organic, like, you know, diabetes in a glass with sugar. And so he was kind of bummed out, but it kind of made sense. And then he's like, well, what about beets? And then and what about, like, carrots? And then what about spinach? And he just kind of went down the glycemic load. You know, it's like more and more or less and less concentrated vegetable sources. But then what he was doing was juicing them and stripping away all the fiber and everything and just leaving basically the water and then whatever the carbohydrate content of that stuff is. And even spinach or wheatgrass juice ends up having a fairly high amount of carbohydrate content, glucose content, and there's absolutely nothing to slow its entry into us. You know, you make 8 ounces of that and you shoot it down, and you basically just took like 25 pounds of broccoli or spinach or whatever and shot it all down at once. Now, a soup obviously is not that processed, but yet it does increase the glycemic index, glycemic load, insulin load of some. I don't know how much. It depends on the vegetables. Depends on how much you cook it. I mean, all this stuff is just really, really variable. But, you know, we were just a second ago, we were talking about, like, say some potential digestive insufficiencies that people could have. Like, they may have low stomach acid or something like that. Soups are a great way of trying to deal with this because it actually makes it more digestible. When somebody is healing from like a serious leaky gut, you know, kind of coming off a gluten sort of gig, some sort of autoimmune issue, soups and stews are phenomenal for this situation because it's actually easier to digest it. But if it's easier to digest, then you have potentially a higher insulin load or glycemic load. So there's trade-offs with all that.
Yeah, I think so. Some of it goes to, you know, where are the goals? You know, where are you sort of in the process? Are we working on digestion first? Do we think digestion is good? Or are we working on leaning the person out? I think the other thing, too, is to play with it. I mean, I find for myself, I tend to cook a lot of, like, stews with a ton of meat, and it makes it super easy to consume, you know, large amounts of vegetable matter. To your point, the glycemic index is probably raised a little bit. I don't know that I, you know, personally see that as a big deal, especially in the winter when I'm cold and I'm a big wimp and trying to stay warm.
Exactly.
So, all right. And second part of his question, which I think is a good clarification, is Chris says he has whey post-workout with water, glutamine, and greens. He always thought that whey protein was protein, so it would not cause an insulin spike. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, all proteins release insulin. Dairy proteins release more insulin than pretty much anything else. And protein typically also releases some glucagon, which can have a little bit of a counter-regulatory effect on the whole insulin thing. And really what glucagon does, in my opinion, besides like the mobilization of like carbohydrates or lipids for energy utilization, glucagon release actually helps normalize insulin sensitivity. There's a whole interesting feedback with all that stuff. But the whey protein definitely releases insulin, and it releases it in significant amounts.
Yeah, which I think is, you know, I think we talked about it, and I cannot remember the episode anymore, where generally with folks, before they start to play with whey, our experience is they should lean out before they start playing with that stuff post-workout.
Absolutely. And right. And then in that situation, it may be a great kind of low-carb post-workout recovery deal where you have essentially like whey protein, maybe whey protein and a tiny bit of fat or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that could be a really effective post-workout approach.
Cool. All right. Good question. And then second part of Chris's question, which I think is good for clarification. Omega-3 eggs, thanks for talking about them already, but is there any way of knowing the DHA, EPA levels in the omega-3 that's added, or could the omega-3 be poor quality, like poor quality fish oil? If so, then would it not be better to have organic free-range eggs and then dose up the high-quality fish oil instead?
Wow. This question reminds me a lot of Nikki's questions that she asks me, where she will ask me a yes or no question about something that is completely nebulous and like some sort of a sliding scale. There's really no way to ultimately know the EPA DHA levels of a given batch of eggs. I mean, it's going to vary from chicken to chicken based on, say, like if they are out free ranging, then they're going to have different levels of EPA DHA based on like the amount of bugs versus the amount of grass they're eating. And then if they're being fed flaxseed plus grains, did they get more flaxseed or did they get more grains? I mean, generally what we're banking on is that the omega-3 enriched eggs have more than other stuff. And, it, you know, and the label frequently, if you flip the carton open, it will say approximately what it is. And I think within, like, food regulation guidelines, it can be plus or minus 10% of that. And so you kind of hang your hat on that. Whether or not it would be better to have, like, free-range eggs, you know, organic, to me, may just mean that they were fed organic grains. And that just seems retarded to pay a bunch of extra money for, like, organic grains, because it's still going to have the problem of the omega-3 and omega-6. Ratio being skewed towards the omega-6 and too much arachidonic acid potentially and all that. So, I mean, probably your best bet is like if you can find somebody who is just pasturing their eggs themselves, you know, the chickens are just running around eating whatever they want to eat, and then you just kind of call it good with that. Otherwise, I would still try to track down one that claims to be an omega-3 enriched egg.
Right. Questions are getting more complicated, Rob. I'm going to have to up the game.
I know, man. I did this podcast to try to streamline my email intake, and now I'm spending like 2 hours of pre-reading and research to ask the questions. I don't think it's saving me any time at all.
Ah, Rob. People get to hear your voice now. It's so much more entertaining than some of your dry attempts at sarcasm in your articles.
Great, yeah, and my spell check doesn't have to get worn out.
That's true. No one can comment on your grammar challenges. All right. Yeah. Next question from Will. Thanks for all the great info. Each week he looks forward to the next installment. He's accumulated a few questions over the last few podcasts. First one, symmetry. You mentioned a bodybuilder who had good symmetry in a podcast, if he thinks number 3, and it reminded me of Art Devaney's comments about paleo eating improving body symmetry. Do you agree or have any thoughts or experiences on this?
I don't think Art was talking about food necessarily being a driver of symmetry other than just being lean. I think, you know, Art talks about like the X shape, you know, like kind of broad delts, trap development, you know, low quad development, calf development, of which I have absolutely none, not even from Thai boxing. So I guess I have an upside down A development as far as that goes. So I don't think that had to do at all with, like, in my interpretation of that, the food. It was more kind of the training philosophy, and then the food was just driving the leanness.
Mm. All right, good. Next question. Based on your explanation of problems with nuts, he stopped eating 200 grams of almonds per day and has totally gotten into light coconut milk and shredded coconut, but would like some variety. Did you say that walnuts and macadamians have better composition than other nuts? What about unsweetened baker's chocolate like Lalonde used in his experiment?
The Macs are a good option. I think they're a little better than walnuts, but both of those end up having better omega-3 and omega-6 balance. But again, it's a short chain omega-3, which I'm just not, man, I'm not a fan of any of that stuff, really. And I have to say, from personal experiment and lots of feedback that we're getting, people are doing better on the coconut than what they were doing on the Macs or the walnuts or any of that stuff. So I would just encourage folks to try that and then maybe here and there use the Macs. But I mean, it's totally up to you. Like, roll with it however you want to. But I just see people doing really, really well on the coconut. The unsweetened cocoa stuff, I would have never really thought about that as a fat source. I know it has, you know, like unsweetened cocoa has some stearic acid as the main fat in it. I guess you could do that. It definitely is loaded with antioxidants and theophylline and all that stuff, which makes you feel, theobromine makes you feel in love and all that jive. So that seems good. But I don't really see it being like a fat source per se. I think Matt used that mainly just as kind of like a antioxidant deal and kind of a nice snacky, you know, just something different to throw in the mix.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about this question a little bit to me, and, you know, I don't know Will's background, but it reminds me sort of a lot of folks in what I call zone land always get caught up in, I got to have my fat with my meal, all those things. I think a lot of us, in some cases, end up with cooking with various fats. Obviously, all the meats we're eating are fats, have fats in them, so a lot of our meals are meats, veggies, and it was cooked in fat. I don't know that we're, you know, all of us, Matt Lalonde being the exception, mainlining full cans of coconut every day, you know, not always making these huge coconut curries. You know, in a lot of cases, we're, you know, cooking with olive oil. We're just kind of rolling with whatever of that stuff is left over in the meat and eating our meat and veggies.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and so, you know, I know nuts are super convenient because they're portable and all those things, but it's like, you know, not every meal do I see a lot of folks eating a ton of nuts. I think, you know, as I said, sometimes in zone land we kind of get that that idea that we need that. But there's fat in all the meats that we're eating. We're cooking with fat. And, you know, that's sort of how we roll.
And that's probably plenty. That's probably about as much as you're going to need.
Yeah, yeah. All right, good. Also, there were some posts after a previous podcast about fish oil oxidation countered by vitamin C and E, but Lalonde pointed out that high doses of C and E have downsides. Can you comment on this?
Real high-dose antioxidants seem to shut down the whole hormetic effect. Hormesis is this process whereby you get exposed to some sort of an environmental irritant, whether that is sunlight or exercise or you know, similar things like that, that you then adapt to. And interestingly, real high-dose C, E, and some other antioxidants appears to be so antioxidative that you do not get the same type of adaptation that you would from exercise. So, you know, we've had this understanding that there's an oxidative theory or an oxidative component to aging and to lots of diseases, and that's true. But then the interesting thing is that by dosing people on super high antioxidants, we don't see those diseases going away necessarily. We may even see other types of diseases getting worse and other problems getting worse. So it doesn't mean that oxidative damage isn't a problem. What it means is that we need to manage it in a smart way. So, like, if you're taking a standard kind of paleo zone sort of diet, you should be getting tons of C, E, you know, all these antioxidants and other types of antioxidants that are not really vitamins per se, like mixed carotenoids and all that, out of the vegetables that we're eating in our diet, and that should be plenty to counter fish oil oxidation. And most fish oils come with a little bit of vitamin E in it to help prevent oxidation anyway. So that should be fine. This also, by the way, is part of why taking NSAIDs like ibuprofen post-workout for muscle soreness actually limits your adaptation to that exercise.
Put down the NSAIDs.
Yes.
All right, next question from Will. This is my question of the week, Rob. Not for any reason other than that I'm hungry. Bacon. It doesn't seem to fit with your preference for lean meat, but you say you like good bacon. So what makes for good bacon?
Gee whiz. Kind of like what makes for like a hot fanny on a chick. I don't know. You just, you know it when you see it. Crispy bacon, Trader Joe's, Applewood smoked bacon is real good. We had a whole pig that was raised on like almonds, apples, oranges. Like it was like free range pig or whatever. And it was like the best pork that we've ever had in my life. And so if you can find some sort of a local farm, and you know what? Actually, that reminds me. I need to remember. We can put this in the show notes. There's actually an organic pork producer that is located right outside Chico. It's called Lana Seco Pork, and it's like humanely raised and all that sort of stuff, low carbon footprint if you're into all that sort of jive. I'll try to remember to put that in the show notes, and then folks can actually order products from them.
And I will make a note, Rob, as the person responsible for keeping the wheels on the track, that I get that information from you and put it in the show.
I figured you'd have a personal interest in that, so I think it would get done.
And I think the bacon question is interesting because we do spend a lot of time talking about eating lean meats, but I know you and I consume a fair amount of bacon.
Yeah, and I mean, it just kind of plays out in the wash. Breakfast food maybe is a little fattier, and then the rest of the food usually balances out and is a little bit on the leaner side. It ends up being like some grass-fed ground beef from Trader Joe's, or like they have some really inexpensive whole chickens at Trader Joe's. Like I baked one of those yesterday, and Nikki and I ate on it for a day and a half and all that. So
good bacon makes me happy though, Rob. So
makes everybody happy.
All right, and last question from Will, and this is, I think, another interesting question. How to tinker well? I understand that tinkering is a basic element of figuring out what is right for each person, but you can you provide some advice on how long to try a diet change and any suggestions on how strict to be in keeping other variables constant since life isn't conducted in a lab? I sometimes make adjustments in my diet and see a difference in performance after a couple weeks, but then wonder if the difference is coming from the change in diet or if it's because my sleep was different or because my coach made adjustments to my lifting program or some other factor.
Sheesh. Well, I mean, if you were taking things to that level, then this is probably the point where you want to start weighing and measuring your food. And, if you're really legitimately wanting to keep that type of control on stuff, then you might want to weigh and measure your food so that you can keep that factor as tight and controlled as you possibly can. I think you can get a lot of mileage out of simply, like, low-carb paleo, where, let's say, we're trying to fuel like a CrossFit Games athlete, where, like Jolie Gentry, Laura DeMarco, other people that we've worked with, most of their meals are protein, veggies, and fat, eaten pretty much, reckless abandon, like they just eat to satiety and they feel good. Post-workout meals are protein and carbs, carbs mainly coming from things like yam and sweet potato, maybe some applesauce. And we get remarkable success with that. I mean, these people are just killing it. And they continue to make progress on that unweighed, unmeasured approach such that I don't feel compelled yet to get in and start weighing and measuring the food to figure out where else we can go with their nutrition to try to get some greater improvement. We've weighed and measured what they are doing. Like we discovered that Jolie, tweaked her protein up and her fat up and everything. And so observationally, we're kind of like, okay, she's eating more protein and fat and she's doing better. And, there we go. But I'm not seeing a need to tweak things because she's still making PRs like week to week, month to month. So I think one of the biggest points at which you will start tinkering is when you cease to make progress. If some part of your game ends up flatlining, and if that means that you're trying to lean out and you flatline, then you need to take a greater level of detail on it. If you're trying to gain muscle mass and you flatline, then you need to take a better degree of detail on it. So I think it's whenever you stop making some sort of progress that you start really needing to tighten up your game and look at what you're doing so that you can make some informed decisions about how you're tinkering.
Yeah, and I think some of this we've talked about comes back to, where you are in the life cycle of development, and then how much are you willing to chase some of these small amounts of improvements. It's like for a lot of things, I'm going to paraphrase Kelly Starrett here, and I know when he said this, he was not talking about some of these other factors, but, you know, if you don't see change, you didn't make change. So it's like, for me, like the nut thing, it was pretty obvious when I pulled nuts out, I felt better, I was leaner, you know, and that was good enough for me. There are other things that I think I could track and really, you know, spend a lot of time worrying about, but I'm convinced that the percentage of improvement would be so small that in the grand scheme of my life, it wouldn't be worth it. You know, I'm not an elite athlete by any means. You know, I'm not trying to get in the Olympics. So some of this stuff, you know, kind of like Lance Armstrong's, you know, elbow position on his bike in the Tour de France, it doesn't really matter to me.
Right. But for them, it does.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, and that's a great thing to keep in mind. You know, it's like, who are you? Where are you at? What are your goals? What are your needs? And it's just as fallacious to take the needs, wants, desires of an Olympic athlete and try to stick that on a generalist as it is to take the lack of need for neurotic behavior on the part of an Olympic athlete and also apply it down to the generalist. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Good question. All right. I got a question from Randy. He is a trainee who is looking to switch over to paleo and trim down a bit. She has two kids and half of her thyroid removed. My question is, how much of an effect will missing part of her thyroid be on her losing the little extra chub, and will I need to prescribe an extra low-carb approach, or should traditional low-carb paleo be enough? Any info on thyroid effects and diet would be great.
You know, it's tough to tell here. It's not so much, so she's got half a thyroid. That doesn't really matter so much as what are her actual thyroid levels, like her T3, T4 levels. Does she have normal circulating levels? If she's not producing adequate, is she taking something like Armour or Synthroid to bring that stuff up? So it's really a matter of what is her actual thyroid level. And so assuming it's normal, then and there's a little caveat within that, because we've seen a number of women who are in the, quote, normal level of thyroid, and they ended up supplementing with 150 micrograms per day of iodine, and they ended up seeing some improved body composition and some improvements and what appeared to be some insulin resistant type stuff, like a little bit of polycystic ovarian syndrome, some endometriosis and stuff like that. It was some kind of thyroid or hypothyroid driven insulin resistance that a little supplementation with some iodine ended up fixing. So, you know, that's just a whole other kind of complex deal. But 150 micrograms a day is a normal recommended daily allowance of iodine, so that is not going to hurt someone for them to tinker with it. Obviously, have them check with their doc and all that stuff, but they should be good to go checking that stuff out. Now, any thyroid effects with regards to the diet, if she's already missing part of her thyroid, then this is where I think being really fastidious on that whole gluten-free paleo diet is huge, because we know for a fact that gut irritation is, you know, the precipitating element for autoimmunity is that gut irritation, and a significant section of autoimmunity is focusing on thyroid function, like Hashimoto's thyroiditis and some other hypothyroid conditions are definitely caused by or worsened by gut irritation. So if the individual is already running on half a thyroid, then I would be pretty motivated to protect the other half that you've still got.
Rob, are you walking into a well right now?
Am I drifting away?
You're breaking up a little bit. I don't know what's...
I'm here. You were breaking up last time, but I guess your recording was okay. But nope, I'm still doing the same gig.
All right, I'm just shutting down anything else on my Mac here that could be stealing bandwidth. I don't think I have anything open that could be, but I'm just trying because you know I don't want to impact the quality of your delivery to the world, Rob. This is good stuff at this point. So
well, my delivery sucks bad enough as it is, so we don't have much. We have no margin of error on that. So.
We're just trying to stay 1% above the suck line, Rob. 1%.
Exactly.
All right, so next question. I'm really enjoying your podcast. I've tinkered with low-carb diets for controlling my type 2 diabetes and have a hard time sticking with them. My biggest problem is sleep and not restless legs. I get to the point where I'm almost frantic for sleep and my legs will not stop. I will go get a bowl of cereal or a Clif Bar, and I go right to sleep, and my legs stop. So let's start there. Any thoughts on that?
I'm going to be a huge dick here, and you can continue that process until the type 2 diabetes kills you, and then your restless legs are dumping for good. And it's kind of being a jerk, but I mean, we have some like really significant, but 100% preventable issues going on here. So this is something that, like, if you want it dealt with, you're just going to have to suck it up and deal with it and get through it. And I mean, type 2 diabetes is like having a sunburn. It is reversible. You have a sunburn from overexposure to sun. You have type 2 diabetes because of overexposure to insulin and carbohydrate. Is there going to be a difficult time getting through that? Yes. Is any of this stuff going to get better short of just addressing the issue? No. Restless leg syndrome has to do a lot with vitamin B3, like riboflavin metabolism. You can add some B3 into the mix. That may help you. But cereal and Clif Bars are not going to fix your shit. It's just not.
Okay. And then also, I've been doing some research on tryptophan, its precursors, and insulin, and I'm wondering if there is a connection to what I am experiencing.
Yeah, it definitely can be. When we have chronically high insulin levels, we actually tend to get serotonin receptor site burnout. So not only do we get insulin resistant, we get serotonin resistant in our brain. Tryptophan is the precursor for serotonin and melatonin, and that's definitely part of what's going on. Lights Out, Sleep, Sugar, and Survival talk at length about this stuff. And it's one of those ironic fixes that when people go on a low-carb diet and actually adhere to it, that they end up getting dramatically improved sleep. That's another spot where I would throw in like some Natural Calm. The fizzy magnesium stuff can help with this, but it's still, this is a metabolic problem. This is too carbohydrate.
Sorry for the laughter there, Rob. We're getting all types of feedback today. So it sounds like you're clicking on your keyboard, but I know you're not because you're talking and you can't talk and type at the same time. There's no chance in hell, and I'm not typing on my keyboard. So.
No, just sitting here. So
tell that Keystone Cat to calm himself down today.
If you can see him, he's about to calm down. Yes, but yeah.
All right, and then the last part of this question is, I feel like the lack of sleep then lowers my mood, my ability to get out of bed and exercise, and raises my cortisol levels. I worked nights as a registered nurse for 12 years, and my sleep cycles are problematic at least half of the nights for me anyway.
Ooh, boy. Yeah, the sleep schedule thing is just death. This is almost like an archetypical like night shift nurse. Like these sleep disturbances, inability to really adhere to a low carb diet for any length of time. You just got to get in and do it. There's an ever growing need for a diabetic nurse counsel, so you could have a good job and help the people from the stuff that you've been dealing with. I guess would be my suggestion.
Yeah, that's a tough situation. It's like, you got to fix the sleep.
You got to fix the sleep, and you just got to jump in and tackle that nutrition if you want all this stuff to alleviate and to actually get some forward progress on it.
Yeah. All right, we're going to try one more question, Rob. If you get any more dicey breakup, I think we're going to call it good, or else it's going to sound horrible. Let's give it a shot here on this next one. A question from Sean asking what our take is on this product. I think it's Omega 3. I think this is one of those chia seed products.
Right. I'm not a fan of this stuff. The folks who make it contacted me and wanted me to give them a product endorsement. They weren't even really aware that the short chain omega-3s are definitely not the same as the EPA and DHA. And I guess it'll keep a vegan alive. And I guess that's a good thing, but I'm just not really a fan. I'm not a fan of supplementing with the short-chain omega-3s. That's about as good as I can give that one.
Order, Rob. It's only like the fifth one similar that we got about the chia seed. So it's a very popular question. So I wanted to make sure that we included that because, you know, you have spoken, you've shared your opinion with the world for better or worse.
Well, and they seem like real nice people. It's a nice idea. If folks want to throw a couple of tablespoons of it back a day, I don't think that's going to like hurt them. But it's really, really supplementing with that short chain omega-3 and expecting it to do anything remotely like supplementing with EPA DHA is just completely false.
Yep. All right, so Rob, we're going to do. I think we got time for one more question. I think we're going to drop down to this. We're going to skip the next question and drop down to the question from Jason. Starting off, hello, Solutioners. I like that. We are now branded as Solutioners. That's cool.
It snowed. It completely snowed.
So he asked a pretty unique question, I thought, and he provided a lot of detail, which I don't think we need to get through to talk about. But basically what he said it is, what should his short-term aims be if his ultimate goal is to improve work capacity in all aspects? So I would say this is like the classic CrossFit question. I want to be good at everything. What should my short-term goals be?
Well, you know, it's that same thing again, like Dave Tate, Louis Simmons, anybody that plays with the strength sports a lot, they Berko Chansky, all these people understand that strength before strength endurance, period. And there's a bunch of like posturing and just bullshit that goes on with that, but stronger athletes can produce more power, period. And then you need to get, you know, if we're talking specifically CrossFit, then you need to get strong and technical in the movements that comprise CrossFit for the most part. So squat, deadlift, press, push press, pull-ups, rope climbs. I would argue you should have some competency of walking on your hands. I would love, at the CrossFit Games to see some sort of an event where you do some sort of a metabolic deal and then you have to traverse 100 meters walking on your hands. Last year we saw people who were at high levels of work capacity, but had learned or saw how to do a muscle-up minutes before the event. The year before that, we had people see the clean and jerk in some sort of a controlled format sometimes for the first time minutes before that. And so what this is reflective of is a very nascent, early, young sport. And at some point, people are going to follow that progression of essentially like, you know, a couple of years of legitimate gymnastics training, a couple of years of legitimate Olympic weightlifting or powerlifting training, and then periodized punctuations of work capacity development that looks exactly like what you would do for a wrestler or anybody else, you know, middle distance runner, something like that, somebody who is a glycolytic anaerobic athlete but needs some sort of a power seeking. And so that's how you would chase all this stuff. When you look at how mixed martial arts has developed, you saw like the Gracies originally, who pretty much like thumped on everybody because the jiu-jitsu that they brought to bear was different enough and effective enough that they could shut down people who only had a stand-up game or other grapplers didn't have the technicality and submissions and all that. And so for quite some time, they were able to kind of ride the wave and beat everybody. Then people started figuring out their game. And now for people to be effective in mixed martial arts, they need to have a significant steeping in wrestling, including freestyle and Greco. They need to have a steeping in jits. They need to have a little bit of a Thai boxing game, particularly a clinch. They need some sort of a Greco clinch. They need a legit boxing game. And so they get steeping in development in all of these different areas, and nobody can be world-class in all of them. But if you can get somebody, you know, to that, like, A-level jits game, A-level Thai boxing game, B-level Greco and freestyle game, then overall you have somebody who's a potential world champion in mixed martial arts. And I think we've got a similar story there playing out in the whole sport of fitness with CrossFit, in that you need somebody who's going to have some damn good technicality in the lifts and in some basic gymnastics elements, and then probably 800 meter to 2 mile running, being very, very efficient in at least that modality, but then also wickedly efficient at shorter distances too.
Yeah, and so I think to me it goes back to, I think this is common with most sports is, if your goal is to, improve in all aspects, I think you get as strong and as powerful as you can, and you get as technical as you can, and then you can layer all that work capacity and everything on top of that down the road as needed based on when your competitions and things are.
Right, absolutely. I mean, so much of why boxers can box for so long is because they're efficient. So much of why wrestlers can wrestle so long is because they're efficient. Some of the challenge of CrossFit is that you change day-to-day, event-to-event, you change the events sufficiently that it's hard to always be efficient at what it is that you're doing. That's some of the challenge. That's some of the cool opportunity faced with it also. But to whatever degree you can find efficiency in as much of those movements, or this is where, like, really delineating what are the important things that I need to be good at. Do you need to be real, real good at a power clean and a snatch? Or do you need to be real, real good at a med ball clean and a sumo deadlift tight pull? Or if you've got a double body weight clean and jerk, is that going to give you enough horsepower on a med ball clean or a sumo deadlift tight pull to get you down the road? And that's some stuff that people need to be smart about how they're programming their stuff to be successful with it.
Sure. Yeah, and also encouraging you to practice what you suck at.
Exactly. Although within the Pelican realm of that, there's possibly an argument to keep a real strong eye on what you are good at too.
That's true.
You may be able to get some good mileage down the road and be able to compensate for the shortcomings. I just had a consult with a guy earlier today who, when you look at everything he's bringing to bear, he's like 205 pounds, 530 deadlift, low 2 minute grace. And he said, I just really, really struggle at the longer wads. And I found that he's been trying to do more and more wads. He's been doing some CrossFit endurance and some stuff like that. And he was like, I'm really getting fat through the midsection. And I just asked him, well, what type of sports have you always done? He's like, wrestling, shot putting, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, somehow what his parents did came up, and his dad was an Olympic giant slalom skier, and his mom was a professional tennis player. And it's like, so what does this dude come from? He comes from a stock of explosive, powerful people who probably don't do real well in the development of like slow twitch muscle fibers. And so they can gut that stuff out and do it, but is that where his best strengths lie? No, definitely not. And we saw some pending metabolic derangement and cortisol problems because he's been pushing his work duration and intensity out past really what he's wired up for. Like the dude is wired up to be a thick, strong 205, 215-pound dude with a 600-pound back squat, 600-pound deadlift, and like a 350, 400-pound bench. He's built and wired up to be like an NFL linebacker, and he's trying to turn himself into a middle-distance runner decathlete. And if that's what he wants to do, that's fine. But I told him, why don't you really chase that 600-pound dead, 600-pound back squat, get your bench up, get real good at 200 and 400 meter sprints and get super efficient at that, and then let's come back 6 months from now and then see where you're at, and we can contemplate like a peaking or some sort of an event. But let's build a big engine, let's build a bunch of efficiency, and let's get your metabolic derangement dealt with so that your strength to body weight ratio is better, because right now he's probably carrying about 15 to 18% body fat, whereas before he was carrying about 12% body fat. Which is real telling. The guy got fatter by doing more work, which is that whole cortisol thing again. And we see that again and again and again when people start doing supra-normal volumes of training, not periodizing, not dealing with their downtime effectively. But that's all bullshit and pseudoscience anyway, so.
Good answer. I think of that.
Perfect one to wrap up on that.
Before you spin off the tracks, we're at an hour 5 today, Rob. apologize to the listeners. We do have some funky clicking. We're going to have to get to the bottom of that. I think someone had commented on the notes that it was annoying, and I couldn't figure out what they're talking about today. But as we're recording it, I can hear it live. So I know we're not, neither of us are typing. So we got some feedback stuff to work through. But I think we worked through the audio levels now. So we solved one problem. We discovered another one. So
I told you that we would find something else to bitch at you about, and there you go.
I know. I think the poster said, Andy, your typing is really annoying. I'm like, typing? I'm not typing. But anyway, that is it for episode 9, Rob. Thank you for your time, and I will talk to you next week.
Dude, thank you. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, see you, man.
Bye.